pave the path of the agony of the national states, tire out humanity by suffering, by fears, and by privations, for hunger makes good slaves. Although Tsar Nicholas II declared the Protocols an outrageous forgery back in 1903, or thereabouts, once they became public knowledge, there were many people who did not share his opinion. In 1919, for example, copies were distributed to troops of the White Russian Army, and during the next 2 years, these troops massacred several Jews who they held responsible for the 1917 revolution. Henry Ford, in his newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, also believed the truth of this document and said they fitted in with what had happened in history and what was happening now. Adolf Hitler is also said to have believed in their authenticity. The international Jewish conspiracy he refers to in some German newsreels about the fatherland being ruined through the outrageous reparations demanded by the international financiers at Versailles in 1919 is a clear indication that he believed that Germany had been treacherously betrayed and subjugated by unfair economic conquest, or Pax Judica. As the listener will no doubt recall, this was one of the policies outlined in the brief synopsis of the Protocols. Whether Hitler was right or wrong is not important at this stage. I would now like to draw the listener's attention to a few pertinent points before he or she progresses any further in this work, and they are these. Any impartial investigator conducting an inquiry, be they detectives, historians, journalists, or appeal court judges, can only base their conclusions on the evidence or information which is available to them at the time. This is why many expert opinions change with every passing decade. Every individual has their own pet theories, beliefs, illusions, or prejudices, and these are usually derived from what they have seen or read, without them having made a personal investigation themselves. Obviously, this is not always practicable or impossible. It depends on what the individual wants to know or believe. An ardent zealot of some religious sect, for instance, who has been taught to believe that God created the world in 6 days a few thousand years ago, as explained in Genesis, would not welcome being told that the existence of some stars in the universe, which are thousands of light years away, makes the account of creation given in the Old Testament unacceptable to any intelligent person. By the same token, someone who wanted to believe that their partner was constantly faithful, in spite of circumstances that many other people would consider most suspicious, would probably be very reluctant to engage a private investigator in order to establish the truth of the situation, regardless of what it turned out to be. It was stated earlier that there is no tangible proof that the Protocols originated from Jewish sources, and there have been several books written against the Protocols, which can be obtained from most libraries. These include such titles as Warrant for Genocide by Professor N. Cohen, The Truth About the Protocols, A Literary Forgery by Philip Groves, The Jewish Bogey by Lucian Wolfe, and The History of a Lie and the Truth About the Protocols of Zion by Herman Bernstein. As already mentioned, these books can be obtained or requested from most libraries. However, during the course of this inquiry, I decided to investigate some sources of information that are not available from public libraries, at least not in the UK. To say that what I discovered was most enlightening would be a gross understatement. Disturbing or even terrifying would be more appropriate to any responsible person, as the listener will perceive as the present work continues. In a book which was first published in 1931, and which I might add, you would have extreme difficulty in obtaining from any library in the UK, there is an account of how the Protocols came into general circulation, and it is quite an interesting story. In 1884, the daughter of a Russian general, Mademoiselle Justine Glinka, was endeavouring to serve her country in Paris by obtaining political information which she communicated to General Orgesky in St. Petersburg. For this purpose, she employed a Jew, Joseph Schorst, who was a member of the Mizraim Masonic Lodge in Paris. One day, Schorst offered to obtain for her a document of great importance to Russia on payment of 2,500 francs. This sum being received from St. Petersburg was paid over and the document handed to Mademoiselle Glinka. Schultz, incidentally, fled to Egypt, where, according to French police archives, he was murdered. Mademoiselle Glinka forwarded the French original, accompanied by a Russian translation, to Orgeski, who in turn handed it to his chief, General Cherubin, for transmission to the Tsar. But Cherubin, under obligation to wealthy Jews, refused to transmit it, merely filing it in the archives. Meantime, there appeared in Paris certain books on Russian court life, which displeased the Tsar, who ordered his secret police to discover their authorship. This was falsely attributed, perhaps with malicious intent, to Mademoiselle Glinka, and on her return to Russia, she was banished to her estate in Orel. To the Maréchal de Noblesse of this district, Alexis Sukhotin, Mademoiselle Glinka gave a copy of the protocols. Sukhotin showed this document to two friends, Stepanov and Nihilus. The former had it printed and circulated privately in 1897. The second, Professor Sergius E. Nihilus, published it for the first time in Trasko-Selo, Russia, in 1901, in a book entitled The Great Within the Small. Then, about the same time, a friend of Nihilus, J. Butmi, also brought it out, and a copy was deposited in the British Museum on the 10th of August, 1906. Meantime, through Jewish members of the Russian police, minutes of the proceedings of the Bar Congress in 1897, which was referred to earlier in this work, had been obtained, and these were found to correspond with the protocols. In January 1917, Nihilus had prepared a second edition, revised and documented for publication. But before it could be put on the market, the revolution of March 1917 had taken place, and Kerensky, who had succeeded to power, ordered the whole edition of Nihilus's book to be destroyed. In 1924, Professor Nihilus was arrested by the Cheka in Kiev, imprisoned and tortured. He was told by the Jewish president of the court that this treatment was meted out to him for having done them incalculable harm in publishing the protocols. Released for a few months, he was again led before the JPU, Cheka, this time in Moscow and confined. Set at liberty in February 1926, he died in exile in the district of Vladimir on the 30th of January 1929. A few copies of Nihilus' second edition were saved and sent to other countries, where they were published and translated into several languages. Such is a simple story of how these protocols reached Russia and thence came into general circulation. Mr. Stepanov's deposition, relative to it here, is given as corroboration. In 1895, my neighbor in the district of Tula, Major Retired Alexis Sukhotin, gave me a manuscript copy of the Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion. He told me that a lady of his acquaintance, whose name he did not mention, residing in Paris, had found it at the house of a friend, a Jew. Before leaving Paris, he has secretly translated it and had brought this one copy to Russia and given it to Sukhotin. At first, I mimeographed this translation, but finding it difficult to read, I resolved to have it printed, making no mention of the date, town, or printer's name. In this, I was helped by Arkady Ippolitovich Filipovsky, who at that time was chief of the household of the Grand Duke Sergius. He gave the document to be printed by the district printing press. This took place in 1897. Sergius Nihilus inserted these protocols in his work and added his own commentary, signed Filip Petrovich Stepanov, former procurator of the Synod of Moscow, Chamberlain Privy Councillor, and, in 1897, chief of the Moscow Kursk Railway in the town of Orel, April 17, 1927. Witnessed by Prince Dmitry Galitsyn, president of the Russian colony of emigrants at Stary Pontine. This book, which incidentally is called Waters Flowing Eastward, like many other books, contains a mine of information, including the full text of the protocols, and is not generally available through the mainstream media, and one certainly could not buy it in W.H. Smith's and other leading bookshops. Nowadays, very few people will have even heard of the protocols. Indeed, during the research into this work, I have interviewed hundreds of people, including several journalists, Freemasons, and one person who was a second constable in the Knights Templar. Had never heard of them. Another interesting point worthy of mention is that although there is no direct, tangible proof that they came from Jewish sources, international jury have gone to extraordinary lengths to state that they were a forgery. This is fair comment, but something which must be taken into consideration is that a forgery has to be forged from something. What were they forged from, and by whom? International jury has also gone to extreme lengths to suppress the publication of this document. Just before closing on this theme, I would like to say a few words about a man who was at one time a famous sports presenter, but he stepped out of line with the establishment and has since been vilified and maligned by the mainstream media. He has written several books and has given a tour of lectures. Some of his books are available in certain bookshops, along with various audio and videotapes. This man's name is David Icke. In his controversial book, The Robot's Rebellion, and on the video of the same title, he explains in considerable detail how we are all manipulated, brainwashed robots, and subject to a very subtle but powerful form of global tyranny, which we can emerge from. One, if we know what's going on, and two, if we are prepared to do something about it. This is largely due to the control of money, which has already been outlined. The reason I'm mentioning David Icke, because in the Jewish Chronicle, as recently as the 9th of June, 1995, he was on a speaking tour, and there's an article headed, Icke says protocols are guide to modern history. And I'll quote a few extracts from this article. David Icke said this week that neither he nor his controversial book, Robot Rebellion, are anti-Semitic, although he spoke approvingly of the anti-Jewish Tsarist forgery, the protocols of the Elders of Zion. During a British speaking tour, the former sports broadcaster and Green Party spokesman has been promoting Robot Rebellion, which sets out a world conspiracy theory and cites as one source a book based on the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Mr. Icke denied knowledge of the origins of the protocols, the forged tract on a purported Jewish conspiracy for world domination. However, he said that, from the hindsight of 1995, they predict in an extraordinary way what has happened in the 20th century. The fact that there were plenty of books around saying the protocols are a load of rubbish was a testimony to freedom of choice, he said. Anyone who is familiar with David Icke's books, tapes, and videos will understand this. I will now return to the Talmud. Apart from constant references to human excrement and semen, what the Talmud teaches about Jesus Christ is unprintable. The Talmud, in fact, contains the most terrible blasphemies against Christ and incitements to hatred against Christians ever written. The hatred against Christ, Christianity, Christians, and, in fact, all non-Jews, or goyim, which is inculcated into many Jewish hearts and minds through the vile contents of the Talmud, spills out into all kinds of cultural media, not least films. Jews have been in control of the film business, particularly in Hollywood, almost since the very beginning of this medium. This stranglehold is reinforced by the total Jewish domination of the major coast-to-coast television networks in the United States. In fact, Jews dominate the films, TV media, throughout most of the rest of the West. A recent example of Talmud-inspired hatred was the film The Last Temptation of Christ, in which Christ is depicted as a lunatic, a bungler, a mental case, who falls down in fits. Martin Luther, 1483 to 1546, one of the key figures in the Reformation, a scholar of Hebrew and Arabic, was one of the first to expose the evil contained in the Talmud. He did this in his last work entitled The Jews and Their Lies, which in essence argued that the root cause of Gentile anti-Semitism is Jewish anti-Gentilism. The Talmud justifies and encourages every possible kind of depraved act, including acts of sexual intercourse with infants, to say nothing of murder, theft, and perjury, providing that such acts are carried out against the goyim, to whom the Jewish sages concede the status of bipeds, but not fellow human beings. Numerous scholars, since Martin Luther, have exposed the vileness of the Talmud, such as Father I.B. Pronietis, a Lithuanian Roman Catholic professor of theology and Hebrew at St. Petersburg, Russia, during the 1890s, whose book, The Talmud Unmasked, obtained an official Roman Catholic Church imprimatur. Benjamin Friedman, himself a Jew, included in his book, Facts Are Facts, a summary of the blatant and incorrigibly evil anti-Gentile teachings of the Talmud. He wrote, "From the birth of Jesus until this day, there never have been recorded more vicious and vile blasphemies of Jesus, of Christians, and the Christian faith by anyone, anywhere, or any time that you will find between the covers of the infamous 63 books which are the legal code which forms the basis of Jewish religious law. You will have to excuse the foul, obscene, indecent, lewd, and vile language you will see from the official unabridged translation of the Talmud into English." I feel at this stage that a few words about organized evil will be in order. In the 1920s, Henry Ford demonstrated that Jews were behind much of the organized evil in America. His articles on the subject were originally published in his newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, and later reprinted and expanded in his famous book, The International Jew. By the way, try and get that from a library if you can. The learned historian Nestor Webster, writing at about the same time as Ford, showed that much the same situation prevailed in Europe. Her book, Secret Societies and Subversive Movements, is of particular interest. Her researches constitute the starting point of the next topic regarding Masonic secret societies and how they are controlled by Jewry. In the days before Britain's security services were thoroughly penetrated by communists, liberal internationalists, and members of the Rothschild family, the historian Nestor Webster was often invited to give lectures to members of the Secret Service on the origins of world unrest and subversion. She traced the origins of the network of the communist international subversion to their Jewish sources. She was familiar with much of the research material which I spoke about earlier regarding communism and the Jewish connection. Through her researches, she was able to link the intellectual origins and techniques of subversion employed by the Communist International with the world of Masonic secret societies. Indeed, she was able to show that both movements at heart were Jewish in inspiration and key personnel. When the core objectives of each movement are considered together with their Jewish intellectual inspiration, it can be seen that they are essentially the same movement, a movement of Jewish revolt against Christian European civilization. Nestor Webster was quite frank about the Jewish connection. She declared that another secret society existed within Freemasonry, for which the visible organization of the latter serves merely as a cover. She identified the hidden controlling group within Freemasonry as the Jewish power. The Protocols of Zion state, "It is this which has served as the basis for our organization of secret masonry, which is not known to, and aims which are not even so much as suspected by these boy cattle, attracted by us into the show army of Masonic lodges, in order to throw dust into the eyes of their fellows. Masonry blindly serves as a screen for us and our objects." The protocols speak with scathing contempt for Masons. They are simply the stupid goy cattle, in complete ignorance of its real aims and who exactly forms a controlling hierarchy. Freemasons are gullible pawns and dupes who have been enlisted in the service of international Jewry to further their secret aims and objectives. As explained in this lecture, foremost is the world government and the destruction of all Gentile races and nations, and particularly the destruction of white European races and nations. Put succinctly, Freemasons are busily engaged in working for their own destruction. Rather like some other well-intentioned but misinformed organizations with high-sounding slogans, such as the Anti-Fascist Action Group and so on. Indeed, if the latter could really understand who controlled them and why and which way they were heading, they would concentrate their efforts in a totally different direction. According to some estimates, 1 in 50 British males is a Freemason. Many prominent people in politics, the civil service, the judiciary, financial institutions, education and so on are Masons. The police service throughout the United Kingdom is especially noted for being dominated by Masonry. Writing of the Judeo-Masonic control behind the drive towards world government, Admiral Sir Barry Donville stated in From Admiral to Cabin Boy, "It is a tragedy that the British people have been so ill-informed on this crucial matter and so careless in the way that they have been governed as to permit this secret junta to gain control over their affairs. The Jews form only a small minority in each country and would be unable to ensure the execution of their policy unless they could obtain the collaboration of persons in the government service. Obviously, this could not be done openly, or the whole plan would be exposed and exploded." This point, incidentally, was stressed very strongly by David Icke in his book, The Robot Rebellion. They must, therefore, build up some secret organization, and what could be better than the one already in hand, Masonry, in which Jews figure so prominently? That is the simple explanation, and it only became necessary to try and establish chosen men in key positions in the government offices and in organizations like the police to put the machine in working order. Commander Guy Carr, a lifelong student of secret societies, was convinced that Freemasonry was controlled at the top by a Masonic sect known as the Illuminati. In his book, Pawns in the Game, he revealed that the Illuminati is an elite secret society founded by a Jew, Professor Adam Weishaupt, in 1776. The Illuminati devised a plan to destroy Western civilization and literally to implement the program of Satan on Earth in opposition to God. It never worked for immediate success. All its plans were long-term. Founder members included a number of Jewish bankers, Itzig, Friedlander, and Meir Amschel, founder of the Rothschild dynasty. Commander Guy Carr believed that the Illuminati has been behind all the troubles, misery, and carnage of the past 2 centuries, including all the revolutions, wars, and depressions, and is, today, the driving power behind the mixing of races. In a remarkable work published by John Robison, M.A., in 1798, entitled Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All Religions and Governments of Europe, is the following statement by the Abbarou concerning the Illuminati. "In the desires of a terrible and formidable sect, you have only reached the first stages of the plans it has formed for that general revolution which is to overthrow all thrones, all altars, annihilate all property, deface all laws, and end up by dissolving all society. The protocols also contain the outline or draft of the plan of action to destroy Christian civilization and establish a one-world dictatorship controlled by Jews. The principles and policies of the protocols are not new. The same morality of limitless ambitions, burning greediness, merciless vengeance, hatred and malice is to be found in the Talmud. This is the motivation which has driven Jews throughout the centuries." At this point, it must be stated that it would be absolutely ludicrous to state that every Jew on this planet is constantly plotting economic catastrophes and wars and so on against every race except their own. Strange to say, the only real opposition the international or Zionist Jews have met with has been from individual Jews, probably mainly Sephardim, who have objected to the power policy and have seen that it must inevitably end in great harm to all Jews. In 1492, Shimon, chief rabbi of Spain, wrote to the Grand Sanhedrin in Constantinople for advice when the expulsion of Jews from Spain was pending. The reply of the Sanhedrin is to be found in the 16th century book La Silva Curiosa by Julio Ineguez de Medrano. A photostat copy of the original and a translation are to be found in the edition of the Protocols, published in the United States by the Sons of Liberty. The text of the reply is as follows. Beloved brethren of Moses, we have received your letter in which you tell us of your anxieties and misfortunes which you are enduring. We are pierced by a great pain to hear it as yourselves. The advice of the grand satraps and rabbis is the following. 1. As for what you say that the king of Spain obliges you to become Christians, do it, since you cannot do otherwise. 2. As for what you say about the command to despoil you of your property, make your sons merchants, that they may despoil, little by little, the Christians of theirs. 3. As for what you say about making attempts on your lives, make your sons doctors and apothecaries, that they may take away Christians' lives. 4. As for what you say of their destroying your synagogues, make your sons canons and clerics in order that they may destroy their churches. 5. As for the many other vexations you complain of, arrange for your sons to become advocates and lawyers, and see that they always mix in affairs of state, that by putting Christians under your yoke, you may dominate the world and be avenged on them. 6. Do not swerve from this order we give you, because you will find by experience that, humiliated as you are, you will reach the actuality of power. Signed, the Prince of Jews of Constantinople. One of the most disturbing revelations during this investigation concerns deliberately contrived wars. Long ago, Clausewitz, a student of war and exponent of military tactics, wrote, "Modern wars are the pursuit of policy by other means. That is to say that wars are prime fights between the populations of A and B for the benefit of C." In 1905, Lenin wrote in The Two Tactics of Social Democracy, "Ally yourselves with one of your enemies against another and destroy them one by one." This has always been the policy of Jews. George Knopfler wrote, "It is not difficult to see that precisely this technique is being used by the Soviets, also in international relations. It is in this light that we must see the Red Alliance with the Nazis and then with the West in the Second World War." In 1952, a document fell into Gentile hands which proved that the Jews were anxious to move rapidly ahead with their familiar plans for dictatorship over the world. The unchallenged transcript of a speech by Rabbi Emanuel Rabinovich was documented as having been delivered before the Emergency Council of European Rabbis in Budapest, Hungary, on January the 12th, 1952. "Greetings, my children. You have been called here to recapitulate the principal steps of our new program. As you know, we had hoped to have 20 years between wars to consolidate the great gains which we made from World War II. But our increasing numbers in certain vital areas is arousing opposition to us, and we must now work with every means at our disposal to precipitate World War III. The goal for which we have striven so concertedly for 3,000 years is at last within our reach, and because its fulfillment is so apparent, it behooves us to increase our efforts and our caution tenfold. I can safely promise you that before 10 years have passed, our race will take its rightful place in the world, with every Jew a king and every Christian a slave. This brought applause from the gathering. You remember the success of our propaganda campaign during the 30s, which aroused anti-American passions in Germany. At the same time, we were arousing anti-German passions in America, a campaign which culminated in the Second World War. A similar propaganda campaign is now being waged intensively throughout the world. A war fever is being worked up in Russia by an incessant anti-American barrage, while a nationwide anti-communist scare is sweeping America. This campaign is forcing all of the smaller nations to choose between the partnership of Russia or an alliance with the United States. Our most pressing problem at the moment is to inflame the lagging militaristic spirit of the Americans. The failure of the Universal Military Training Act was a great setback to our plans, but we are assured that a suitable measure will be rushed through Congress immediately after the 1952 elections. The Russian, as well as the Asiatic peoples, are well under control and offer no objections to war, but we must wait to secure the Americans. This program will achieve its objective, the Third World War, which will surpass in destruction all previous contests. Israel, of course, will remain neutral. And when both sides are devastated and exhausted, we will arbitrate, sending our control commissions into all of the wrecked countries. The war will end for all time our struggle against the Christians. We will openly reveal our identity with the races of Asia and Africa. I can state with assurance that the last generation of white children is now being born. Our control commissions will, in the interests of peace and wiping out interracial tensions, forbid the whites to mate with whites. The white women must cohabit with members of the dark races, and the white men with black women. Thus, the white race will disappear, for mixing the dark with the white means the end of the white man, and our most dangerous enemy will become only a memory. We will embark upon an era of 10,000 years of peace and plenty, the Pax Judica, and our race will rule undisputed over the earth. Our superior intelligence will easily enable us to retain mastery over a world of dark peoples. This brought a question from the gathering. Rabbi Rabinovich, what about the various religions after the Third World War? Rabinovich, there will be no more religions. Not only would the existence of a priest class remain a constant danger to our rule, but belief in an afterlife would give spiritual strength to irreconcilable elements in many countries and enable them to resist us. We will, however, retain the rituals and customs of Judaism as the mark of our hereditary ruling caste, strengthening our racial laws so that no Jew will be allowed to marry outside our race, nor will any stranger be accepted by us. We may have to repeat the grim days of World War II, when we were forced to let the Hitlerite bandits sacrifice some of our people in order that we may have adequate documentation and witnesses to legally justify our trial and execution of the leaders of America and Russia as war criminals after we had dictated the peace. I am sure you will need little preparation for such a duty, for sacrifices has always been the watchword of our people, and the death of a few thousand Jews in exchange for world leadership is indeed a small price to pay. To convince you of the certainty of that leadership, let me point out to you how we have turned all of the inventions of the white man into weapons against him. His printing presses and radios are the mouthpieces of our desires, and his heavy industry manufactures the instruments which he sends out to arm Asia and Africa against him. Our interests in Washington are greatly extending the Point 4 program for developing industry in backward areas of the world so that after the industrial plants and cities of Europe and America are destroyed by atomic warfare, the whites can offer no resistance against the larger masses of the dark races who will maintain an unchallenged technological superiority. And so, with a vision of world victory before you, go back to your countries and intensify your good work until that approaching day when Israel will reveal herself in all her glorious destiny as the light of the world. This document, which originally reached the United States in Yiddish, was translated by Henry H. Klein, a very brave Jew, who was terrified by the plans of his people to precipitate an atomic war. Klein later died mysteriously in New York after a Central Intelligence Agency man visited him, and the CIA now has the original of this document in its files in Washington. A double agent who had infiltrated the inner circle of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith told a writer in 1956 that the publication and circulation of Rabbi Rabinovich's speech in 1952 by a handful of American patriots had caused the Jews to postpone all their plans and had averted the horrors of the Third World War. Colonel H. A. Lane wrote in his privately published 1938 book, The Hidden Hand, "In order to bring about Jewish world domination, it is necessary from time to time to engender wars so that the most virile and patriotic men are killed or crippled, physically or mentally." Clemenceau, French leader during the First World War, arrived at exactly the same conclusion. He wrote, "The Semitic race has a program for the extermination of other races and the peopling of the whole earth with their own blood. Their zeal for this cause is such that in comparison with this, nothing else matters at all. To this cause, no sacrifice is too great, no suffering too terrible." Kurt Kehlen, a spokesman for General Ludendorff, commander of the German army in the First World War, wrote of the skill by which jury is able to divide white nations so that they cut each other's throats for jury's gain. He was quoted in Nestor Webster's book, Rush and Bolshevik. In his book, The Hidden Tyranny, Benjamin Friedman claimed that the Jews prevented the First World War from ending in 1916 when a German peace offer was on the table at the British War Cabinet and needed only one signature to end the carnage. Great Britain would have quickly accepted Germany's October 1916 peace offer if the World Zionist Organization had not interfered. The British War Cabinet was then taking their instructions from Talmudist Jews in London. Numerous Jewish sources have admitted that they were behind the two world wars. The Jewish World of London, dated the 16th of January 1919, declared, "International Judaism forced Europe into war, not only to seize a large part of the gold paid out in armaments and their seizing of the gold bullion in Russia, but to start a new Jewish world with the help of this gold." A prominent London Jew, Dr. Oscar Levi, wrote, "We Jews who have posed as saviors of the world are today nothing but the world's seducers, its destroyers, its incendiaries, its executioners." Dr. Levi wrote the preface to a book by George Pitt Rivers in 1920 entitled The World Significance of the Russian Revolution. Henry Ford wrote in his book, The International Jew, "I studied the causes of war, and I am convinced that nearly all wars were caused so that someone would profit, and those who profited and those who are profiting now are the international financiers, the Jews. Two very prominent Jews began telling me about the power of the Jewish race, how they control the world through gold, and that the Jew, and no one but the Jew, could stop the war." He was referring to World War I. "They went into details to tell me the means by which the Jews control the war, how they had the money, how they cornered all the basic materials needed to fight the war, and all that, and they talked so long and so well that they convinced me. They said that the Jews had started the war and would continue it as long as they wished, and until they stopped the war, it would not be stopped. Gather together the 50 most wealthy Jewish financiers, the men who create wars for their own profit, control them, and you will put an end to it all." The fratricidal wars of the century, colored immigration, the erosion of standards and values, the promotion of perversion and degeneracy in all its forms, the corruption and debasement of music, art, and literature, is all part of the same program. the annihilation of the Anglo-Saxon Celtic people of Britain, the incorporation of the British nation into a one-world government controlled by the very people behind all the mischief and carnage of the 20th century. If anything demonstrated the Jews' ability to get Gentiles fighting wars to serve Jewish power, it was the mobilization of almost all the member nations of the United Nations organization to pursue firstly sanctions and then all-out war against Iraq on the pretext that Iraq had invaded its neighbor, the Kingdom of Kuwait. For centuries, Kuwait was a part of Iraq during the Turkish Ottoman Empire. Kuwait was created by British administrators after the First World War. Arbitrary border lines were drawn over a map of the Middle East, probably with a school ruler. The most powerful families who had served Britain well during the war were rewarded with kingdoms. The artificial kingdom of Kuwait was fortunately positioned over a huge lake of oil. Iraq had long campaigned for Arab oil-producing nations to ration their production and sale of oil to world markets in order to maintain a high price for this commodity, which in due course will run out. Iraq also wanted the Arab nations to use oil productions as a lever to compel the West to deal more fairly with the Arab world in general and with the Palestinians in particular. For decades, representatives of Arab oil-producing nations would meet under the auspices of their coordinating body of OPEC to thrash out an agreed production quota for each nation and an agreed price. Within weeks, sometimes hours, of such agreements, smaller members of the body, notably little kingdoms such as Kuwait, ruled by a single family or clan who treat the country as if it were their own private corporation, would disregard the quota and price agreements and sell as much as they could for whatever price they could get. As often as not, the main reason for this irresponsibility was the need for more ready cash to squander in the casinos and nightclubs of the West and to maintain lifestyles of unimaginable luxury as and when they happened to return home. Kuwait did not need to behave in such a manner, as its investments around the world were producing more income than their oil production. But the greed of former goat herders turned billionaires knows no bounds. The exasperation of Iraq finally boiled over when the Iraqis discovered that the Kuwaitis were not only pumping out their own oil at a rate in contravention of the OPEC agreements, they were also pumping out Iraqi reserves from under their mutual border. This was the immediate cause of the Iraq invasion of Kuwait. Saddam Hussein, leader of Iraq, had no reason to suppose that the world would be mobilized against him. Over the previous couple of decades, both the West and the Soviet Union had supplied him with armaments. Britain and America had sided with him in his war against Iran, when that nation was believed to be the greatest threat to the West and Zionism. But with Iran exhausted by war, and with a new and slightly less fanatical Muslim fundamentalist leadership, Iraq became the biggest single threat to the West and to Israel. The West wants as much oil as it can get as cheaply as possible. It does not want Saddam Hussein imposing a production and price discipline on the Arab world. The Zionists did not want Iraq to galvanize the previously disunited and chaotic Arab nations into putting up a united front against Israel and using oil as a weapon to force the West to give justice to the Palestinian people. So the Iraq invasion of Kuwait was made the excuse for mobilizing the world to defend poor little Kuwait, to uphold democratic standards, etc., etc. All this, of course, was the sheerest hypocrisy. The world community did not rise up and impose sanctions and then declare war on Israel when Israel invaded the Lebanon. The world community is still doing nothing about the Chinese invasion of Tibet and the extermination of the peaceful Tibetan people. The West still supports the genocidal Khmer Rouge terrorist force in Cambodia despite its monstrous record of genocide. It must surely be obvious to all that the world community was not mobilized against Iraq for the sake of Kuwait's freedom, democracy, civilized standards of international diplomacy, and other such propaganda objectives, but to crush Iraq as a threat to the Jewish-dominated international oil cartels and, above all, as a threat to Israel. Military force, though on nothing like such a huge scale, was employed by America against General Gaddafi's Libya in 1985 for precisely the same reasons. Those who doubt the truth of this analysis of why Iraq was crushed might care to ponder the reported words of President Mitterrand of France. I assure you, France won't go to war in an American car driven by Israel.